This is Ozarks at Large for December 26th. I'm Katie Henriksen.
Oh, I'm Jacqueline Froelich taking notes.
I'm Timothy Dennis.
I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. We're all together during the programs this week because we're talking about some of our favorite stories that we've done this year. We'll do it today, tomorrow, and Friday as well. And be ready, everyone, because I've got a question to ask at the end of the show. And the look of fear that's on everyone's, they're never that tough. I want to start with a story that you picked as one of your favorites this year, Christina. Okay. It's about a glassblower.
Yes.
And glassblowers, you expect, you know, might have a studio somewhere in the middle of the Ozarks, or their wares might be at a gift store at Silver Dollar City at some artisan place. That wasn't the case here.
No. The University of Arkansas has a glassblower that does work on their science equipment, you know, beakers and tubes, and he can make, you know, specialized, you know, I mean, custom pieces. And it's really unique. Most schools, a lot of universities don't have them, and he does stuff for other schools. Other schools will send him stuff to work on because he's really good at his craft. But one of the... I picked it for various reasons. You know, there's good sound, you know, the fire and, you know, drills and whatnot. But also, one of the great things about this job is getting out there and meeting interesting people and people that are really enthusiastic about what they do, but don't always have the opportunity to share their story. And this guy loves what he does. And he, you know, is in this lab by himself most of the day. And I just really enjoyed getting to talk to him and see how much he loves what he does.
A wet saw starts up and begins grinding on a tube of glass in a shop and engineering hall on the University of Arkansas campus. It is the equipment of the U of A's resident glassblower, who works primarily with things that are used in the various science departments on campus. Picture beakers, tubing, flasks, and other glass vessels. Due to its impermeable nature, glass is an important tool in science, especially chemistry.
If you want to run a reaction outside of air, glass container is your best bet. Because, you know, you can heat it and do things like that. And you can tailor your container for exactly what you want to do.
That's Bill Durham, professor in the U of A's chemistry department. He says that having somebody on campus that can make specialized equipment is critical to what students and teachers are doing. Dr. Matt McIntosh, also a professor in the chemistry department, agrees that the presence of a glassblower on campus is important.
Because we have a couple reasons. One is that we have, I and other groups, research groups, have needs for custom setups of various kinds. So you can buy a lot of glassware from various commercial supply houses, but they're going to be in sort of standard shapes and sizes and configuration. But for custom configurations, which are very common, you really need to have someone on site that you can go and talk to and describe what you want, and they can describe... John can describe how it could be put together and what the possibilities are.
What I do, the work that I do, I take glassware that can be made in a mold in a machine.
That's John Pace, the U of A's resident scientific glassblower.
And so anything single-walled and symmetrical can pretty well be made in a mold.
Okay.
And this consists of vessels, valves, joints, and filters of various kind. And then I'll assemble that into some type of apparatus. Like this isn't really, you know, there's something, you know, inside. The machine really can't do that.
John Pace's position is a unique one, and one that he happened into. As a student studying wildlife management at the University of Missouri, he worked in the benefits office. That office was next to the HR department, and he saw that they wanted an apprentice glassblower.
And that sounded better than, you know, working in the benefits and filling out cards. This was before, you know, much on the computer was going. The glassblowing sounded better, so I applied for it, and basically, the requirement was to be, you know, to be able to get along with a cantankerous glassblower, you know, type of personality, and then to be a bit have dexterity in your hands. And I typed really well, and I played guitar, and I got along with the guy. And that's how I got the job.
He says it turned out to be interesting. He had always enjoyed carpentry, machinery, and seeing how things worked. When he graduated, he found that glass blowing was just as profitable as having a BS in wildlife management, and has now been blowing glass for over 30 years, working both in academia and for private companies. He prefers the work at a university, it being more versatile and providing more freedom.
And a little bit more thinking involved. You know, you're dealing with students and the professors, and you're developing items sometimes that haven't been used before.
John has been with the U of A for 12 years, a position that he waited 4 years to step into, as jobs as scientific glassblowers are not a dime a dozen. Due to changing research methods, increasing in the ease of communicating with off-site glassblowers, and administrators' diminishing value, few glassblowing shops exist at universities in the United States.
It's only the major universities that have ever had glassblowers. It requires, you know, a substantial chemistry department or scientific, you know, departments to have enough work to do glassblowing.
In addition to the chemistry department, engineering and crop, soil, and environmental sciences utilize his services. But even with all of the work the U of A has, John still has the time to work for universities that do not have enough work to employ a full-time scientific glassblower. Scattered about his shop are large boxes and crates with equipment that comes from schools such as the University of Missouri and University of California, San Diego. Both are schools for which Mr. Pace has previously worked. He claims to have OCD tendencies, something that the professors are used to and count on, finding it worthwhile to send him pieces for repair. That is what he's working on today. The piece is a tube, or column, about an inch around and a foot long. One end is a glass ball, a bit larger than a softball. This ball is broken.
And yeah, I'm going to put, you know, basically seal this onto it and then seal this onto the top of that. And just kind of a two-step thing. I'd left pick that so you could see what was there. You know, that's how something is sent. There it is. Fit there. And then I'll just...
He places the piece in a lathe, a large machine that holds and turns the glass while he's working on it. Once the glass is safely in the lathe and begins to turn, he puts on protective eyewear and inserts a thin, non-glass tube into his mouth and fires up his torch. He uses the heat from the torch, centrifugal force, pressure from his breath and gravity to remove the broken ball, to force an opening into the new ball of glass, and to attach it to the old column.
When things go right on this, it looks just as easy and, you know, simple to do, but there's a lot more going on than meets the eye.
Though John works with a close eye and a steady hand, there's blood coming from a cut on his right hand. A cut that he got while cleaning up his workbench. It's an occupational hazard that he says has gotten better with experience.
The first month that I worked, I had a Band-Aid on every finger and multiple Band-Aids on several fingers, and that is not an exaggeration. Hot glass looks just like cold glass. And at first, you also cut yourself. You'll reach out and pick up something that, you know, has a sharp edge on it, and you're just, you know, not paying attention enough. You do need to be meticulous in your movements, and you develop essentially a method of when you make something, you set it down the same way to where the hot end is always, you know, on the same end or away from you or whatever, and you just develop technique.
Most probably picture an artist at the mention of a glass blower, but John says his work is not an art, but rather a craft.
What I am maybe is a Xerox machine. If somebody, you know, can come up with a configuration and it's possible to make, you know, out of glass, I can do that, you know, with their design. But whenever I try to create art, I fail, you know, I don't know when to stop. I keep, you know, trying to adjust. And
this is Ozarks at Large, talking about some of the favorite stories that we did this year. One of the great things, I think, for our job sanity is that we get to pick stories. We get to do things that we wouldn't at other places. Some of them are very interesting features, like the glassblower. Some are more about policy and talking to some experts. And Jackie, you had a story this year about same-sex classrooms.
Yes.
And it was very interesting.
Because when you were, okay, so, Tim, when you were in grade school, do you remember the little girls and what it was like dealing with them?
Yeah, pulling their pigtails, you know, chasing them around the playground.
Oh, my goodness, you're acting like you're 75. Did you dip them in the inkwell or something?
No, we didn't have inkwells.
And he's in his early 20s, by the way.
But I remember it well.
Distracting and unnerving and make you angry and just when you mix up little boys and little girls, it's quite a dynamic. So there's some schools in several years ago, actually 5 years ago, I went to Farmington because I heard from a mom, her kid was in a single gender classroom. I thought, that's crazy. We had Title IX, which mandated all, you know, there was no, you know, classrooms would be open, no stereotyping, no opportunities would be limited. Children's civil rights would not be abrogated. So we had Title IX in place. Single gender classrooms seemed to fly in the face of that. And so across the country, classroom by classroom, they seem to be emerging. And it's this big test across the nation. Now, that school has since closed its single gender classroom. But we now have, I have a tally, 72. And I had to count with the Arkansas Department of Education and get with them and work it out one afternoon. 72 single gender classrooms across 11 school districts. They didn't even have a count. They were shocked by how many were out there. They queried all the principals across the state, and the principals called in, and they're really excited about it because it turns out little boys and little girls learn differently. And I'll say one more thing. I walked into a room where little boys were learning. It was crazy. They were busy. They were jumping. They were loud. The teacher was into it. She was very vocal and just was, you know, working with them. And then I walked into the little girls' classroom. They're all sitting at their desk, talking to each other, having civil conversations. You know, it's just astonishing.
Let's listen to the story.
The cafeteria at Southside Elementary in Solemn Springs is jammed with children enjoying cheese pizza for lunch. Here, boys and girls sit together, but when lunch is over, nearly half of them file into single-gender classes. Teacher Tammy Murray has instructed an all-boys class of fourth graders, one of 17 single-gender classrooms in the district, for the past 4 years, and she loves it.
You enjoy the stress. Thrill seekers enjoy the stress of things, and so I kind of think of ourselves as thrill seekers. We like the stress of the energy that the boys give us.
And results from the first year her all-boys class began to meet were really encouraging, she said.
100% growth. Every one of our students had made growth that year. And we have 4 points higher than the mixed classes for proficiency. So we have just a slight variation in our benchmark data.
Improving proficiency is what's leading more Arkansas school districts to adopt single-gender classrooms. Superintendents reported 72 such classes across 11 districts for this report, a preliminary tally. Tammy Murray and her colleagues teach self-contained classes, all the core subjects, to the same kids every day, same classroom. But she's taking things a step further and looping classes.
Okay, looping is the act of taking one class and staying with them through one, two, or more grades. Studies are showing what we learned, it's ideal if they'll loop 3 grades, but that's a lot of curriculum for a teacher to know.
By advancing to the next grade level with their students, teachers can pick up with them immediately every fall rather than having to assess a new flock of kids. Research on looping is scant, but evidence suggests that students score higher in reading, language arts, and math. So how does Tammy Murray keep pace with a pack of 28 little boys every single day for several years in a row?
It's exactly the same curriculum. It's just a matter of getting up and moving. For boys, move, 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 move. They can stand if they want to. They stand at the counter. if they need to. They'll stand with a clipboard if they need to. They'll lay on the floor if they need to. We go outside, do lots of running. If you get a correct answer, you can run to the tree and come back. Just lots of movement.
Now compare that kinetic classroom scene to Julie McCraddock's all-girl fourth grade class next door.
That would be hard, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
All right, javelin. What did you learn?
The girls take turns talking about a book they're reading on ancient Greek cultural practices. Evidence suggests that little girls tend to be more assertive when boys are not present. Tammy Murray's boys are taking a break from the books and gym class. The entire school sexually segregated for PE, which is tradition. But do the students prefer being separated during core courses?
They wouldn't be in here if they weren't into it, because they have the option to leave at any point, really. Parents have the option to pull out any time they want. They seem to be into it.
And do you have a preponderance of students and parents who want to be in the single-sex classrooms?
Yeah. We're always full.
Southside Elementary in Siloam Springs is among a growing number of public schools nationwide experimenting with single-gender education. Outlawed in 1972 under Title IX of the Higher Education Act, single-gender classrooms were perceived as discriminatory. But 30 years later, gender-oriented classrooms were permitted under No Child Left Behind, which funded and encouraged innovation. According to the advocacy group, the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education, the number of public schools with single-gender classrooms has increased from 12 a decade ago to 508 nationwide. Even the U.S. Department of Education claims single-gender learning can boost achievement, reduce distractions, and improve behavioral interactions between both teachers and students, as well as among students. But empirical research is lacking, says Professor Sandra Stotsky.
There are teachers who have taught little boys and teachers who've taught little girls who claim that there are some differences in the way little boys learn and how they act in a classroom. So, and same with girls, so that there is some idea of gender-specific pedagogy.
Pedagogy meaning method or practice. A noted scholar in the Department of Education Reform at the University of Arkansas and an expert on standards for teacher education, licensure, and school curriculum, Professor Stotsky and her research team collected data from two elementary schools which had single-sex classrooms in Springdale and in Fort Smith, the first study of its kind. She also observed same-sex classes in the co-ed school settings in other school districts.
No red flags, let me put it that way. We found very positive comments by the principal, the teachers, the few parents and students that we interviewed. No indication that there were any serious problems.
Stotsky's exploratory study, to be published in the Journal of School Choice this winter, searched for both positive and negative dynamics in non-co-ed classrooms.
We know girls do less well in math than boys, and we know that boys do less well in reading and writing than girls. So the question is, are there benefits for either sex or both sexes?
Educators also acknowledge long-held gender reading preferences, although those preferences are changing, Stotsky said.
Girls, as I say, like to read about fictional relationships, some fantasy stories. Boys do like nonfiction. This is a very clear preference. They like stories about sports. They like stories about exploits, adventures, wartime, battles.
Plus, girls act differently than boys.
Any mother who's had, or parent who's had children over the years will know that little girls can sit for long periods of time, read, or play school, play hospital, or play with dolls in carriages or little beds, you know, and little boys don't necessarily want to do this sort of thing. Sandbox play, there are some differences, even when you try to put them all together in the same sandbox and insist that, you know, the girls play with trucks or whatever it is, these differences just occur.
Professor Sandra Stotsky says more exploration of single-sex education is needed in the face of rising demand.
The classes wouldn't be there unless the principal, the parents, and the teachers voluntarily wanted them.
An op-ed article published this month in the Wall Street Journal revealed an unusual bipartisan congressional alliance in support of single-gender education. But critics, like the American Council for Co-Educational Schooling, say single-sex classes are ineffective, claiming mixed-gender classrooms embrace diversity, promote cross-gender cooperation and friendships. And last May, the American Civil Liberties Union sent cease and desist letters to school districts in five states saying same-sex classrooms enforce stereotypes, limit opportunities, and violates children's civil rights. In response to a lawsuit brought by the ACLU, a federal court in West Virginia ordered a middle school to go back to co-education this school year. But Siloam Springs Southside Elementary principal Dan Siemens disagrees with critics.
Well, there are people in powerful places that, even politicians, that think that any kind of choice that a parent might have in public education is totally wrong. Now, if you talk to the parents of these boys, the parents of the girls in these classes that we have here, they would tell you the opposite. They love the choice. They appreciate the choice.
Plus, he said, in his school, an increasing number of students prefer single-gender classes.
The students just love it. They love the all-boys classes. They love the all-girls class. And we have done questionnaires, surveys, if you will, talking to the students about why do you like an all-boys class? Why do you like being in an all-girls class? And it's amazing how the answers are similar. The boys will say, there's no girls in here to mess up our class. Well, they just talk too much and they just mess things up. Now, I'm generalizing here. But the girls say the same thing about the boys. You ask, girls, why do you like an all-girls class? Well, the boys come in, they're just so sloppy. They just mess things up in this class. And so it's amazing how the comfort level in an all-boys or all-girls class is there.
This is Ozarks at Large, the Ozarks at Large staff talking about some of our favorite stories that we worked on this year. It's Boxing Day, by the way. Happy Boxing Day, the 26th of December. Some stories that we do are about policy, education, about poverty, about very serious subjects. Then occasionally we talk about a t-shirt cannon.
Just for fun.
This was part of, on the second anniversary of The Daily Show.
Uh-huh.
You know, every year on the anniversary of doing The Daily Show, we take the traditional anniversary gift. And this, for the second anniversary, was cotton. Mm-hmm. So we did some stories about cotton, and that led you, Antoinette, to Arvest Ballpark.
And you.
And me. That's right. That's right. That's right.
I think it was your idea. And we're like, who would want to play with a t-shirt cannon? Oh, Antoinette.
Was I right?
Oh, you were right. Of course. That was a weird day. We pulled up and it started raining. And
it hadn't rained
at all
for
months
before
like.
That. That broke the
August.
Drought.
Yeah, it was in August. And so even on the way out, it started pouring again, and I ran through the parking lot and lost a shoe. It was just ridiculous. But what was so great is they took us outside to shoot the cannon, bless their hearts, and they were trying to figure out how to keep us under the concourse so we wouldn't get wet. But it constantly surprises me / amuses me how in this job I can just call people and ask random questions like, hey, can I play with this? And they're like, sure.
Not only do they say yes, they say, oh, yeah, and then
they
get ideas.
Happy to do
right.
it. Yeah, so we went out to Arvest Ballpark, and the promotions crew showed us how they use their t-shirt cannon.
Last Thursday, there was a rather unusual scene at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. The baseball diamond was hidden beneath a tarp. As rain fell from a dark and cloudy sky, thunder clapped overhead, and lightning struck an area outside the stadium that was a little too close for comfort. For a brief period of time, there was even some small hailstones bouncing off the floor of the concourse. Under the covered concourse, we met with members of the Northwest Arkansas Naturals front office, including marketing manager Regina Van Hinklum and promotions coordinator Julie Mileto. As we made our way down the south concourse, we stopped and Regina placed a skinny black bag on top of a silver counter where you'll normally find condiment stationed during a home game. She unzipped the bag and revealed a large t-shirt cannon, which is a long, transparent tube connected to a stock with a trigger. After Regina attached an air tank to the bottom of the cannon, she said we were ready to go. Instead of a t-shirt, we were preparing to shoot balls, which Julie explained is part of an in-game promotion for Daisy, where selected fans are able to come onto the field and shoot a ball at a large bullseye bearing Daisy's logo.
Their product is guns, so that's where this one came in.
And it's a commonly used practice in minor league baseball and in sports in general to have t-shirt guns. I've seen some as large as that look like Gatling guns that just pump out t-shirts as quickly as they can. So
this particular t-shirt cannon is new for this season. Julie explained last year's cannon was more complicated for the short amount of time the promotions team is on the field. Julie said they still have the old cannon, which they can use if they need more than one t-shirt cannon for promotion or if something ever happens to the new cannon. She said it takes little training to use the device, and basically all you need to know is how much pressure it requires. This cannon uses a maximum of 250 pounds per square inch, or PSI. But because the target is not too far away, Julie said they try to stay under 200 PSI. In comparison, last year's cannon would reach about 300 PSI in order to hit a target that was located near the bullpen. Street team intern Sydney Thoreau was also part of our group on that soggy afternoon. After a brief lesson on how to use the cannon, Sydney, who had one arm in a sling, trotted to the east end of the concourse to retrieve our balls.
Do you want to give it a shot?
Yeah.
Okay, so where am I shooting it?
Just shoot straight.
Just
shoot
and straight.
Don't hit Sydney.
Oh.
She's going to chase down the ball.
Oh. Okay. She already has it on.
There you go.
Hand.
Just pull the trigger.
Okay.
This is a nice shot. You might have hit our target.
Excellent. Next time.
Should I have a kick?
A little bit. Not too bad. Not too bad. You want to try?
Sure.
Okay.
Hold on.
Sorry. And it's just pull
just
the trigger?
Just aim and pull.
Oh, it's heavier than I thought.
I think it really is the air tank that has the most heat.
I like it. It's like I'm got a scope.
You just
got
to make sure that the ball stays back on the air chamber right there, but you don't have to you don't have to compensate for it. It will just shoot. Just don't let it roll forward.
That is weak. That's cool though.
But it still sounds good.
It does. It sounds real good.
During the course of the season, Regina said they give away thousands of t-shirts.
When we did our calculations with giveaways provided by sponsors, like we've got a Pepsi t-shirt giveaway that we're giving away to about 2,000 people, those happen quite a few times throughout the year, and they have to give a minimum of 1,500 t-shirts. So doing calculations with those, and we give about two t-shirts out a day for our Bat Kids, because they have their own Bat Kids t-shirt. And we calculated about 5,000, 5,000 throughout the year?
Yeah, I think throughout the season we give out pretty close to, if not over, 5,000.
Because we have 70 games, home games in the season, so it adds up.
Yeah.
Are they all natural t-shirts or?
We've got a Pepsi t-shirt coming up, but we also have, we're hosting the 2013 All-Star Game here next year. So at September 1st, we are giving away a 2013 All-Star Game logo t-shirt. So it just depends on who sponsors it and how many we get.
So far, the Naturals have only shot balls and t-shirts out of the cannon, but Regina says she has seen a rubber chicken catapulted out of a t-shirt cannon. These machines do pack a bit of a punch, but Regina assured us that it's a very safe and entertaining addition to a Naturals baseball game.
The only way I could see people getting injured from that is diving to go get the t-shirt, but it's pretty easy. I know we also throw t-shirts off the dugout every single seventh inning stretch, so that's 20 t-shirts every game that we're just throwing to people, and the fans love it, so it's pretty exciting.
That was a t-shirt cannon shot at Arvest Ballpark, part of our second anniversary show about cotton. My memory of that day, because when we're leaving, it's raining really hard, the thunder. And you didn't have an umbrella.
Neither did you.
No. And so you just shoot out to get to the car running. And I remember yelling, look both ways.
You did.
The parental part of me kicked in right there.
You did. I looked at some point. I was going really fast, but I promise I looked at some point. Thank you for grabbing my shoe, by the way.
Yes. Katie, a story that aired not that long ago that you did about two MFA graduates from the University of Arkansas who have really made inroads in screenwriting. I mean, big time.
And quickly, too.
Yes. Including a project with HBO where I think if you're working in drama right now, that's the pinnacle. I'd say even more than Hollywood because HBO, you know, Boardwalk Empire and things like this. Tell us a little bit about this before we hear a portion of this story.
Yeah, Nick Pizzolatto, a pretty recent MFA grad, I think. It's Nick Pizzolatto and Tony Toaster, the two graduates who I spoke to. One of them graduated in 2004 and one was 2005. I can't remember which was which. But Nick started out writing TV for the show, the AMC show, The Killing. And then now he's sold 2 years worth of HBO TV series, and it's going to star Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson.
Right.
So it's pretty amazing.
And one of them is actually working on writing the screenplay for a remake of The Magnificent Seven.
Yes, for Tom Cruise project, and that's right. Also Nick. And then Tony Toast, who is in the program at the same time, he has been writing for this TV show called Longmire, and he's actually now trying to sell his own TV series as well. So
let's listen to part of that.
Nick Pizzolatto, a fiction graduate from 2005, got his break when two of his short stories were published in The Atlantic. And soon after that, his debut novel, Galveston, was published to high acclaim. And it was optioned for film. Pizzolatto decided he wanted to get into film writing, so he began writing for the AMC series The Killing. Though that show is no longer on the air, Pizzolatto is currently in production of a 2-year series that he has sold to HBO, starring Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. The show is called True Detectives, and it's slated to begin airing in 2013. Pizzolatto, who grew up in both New Orleans and Lake Charles, Louisiana, had always wanted to be a storyteller. And he was always drawn to screenwriting. But growing up far from either of the coasts where anything happens in film or television, he wasn't sure how to get there.
I always wanted to be a storyteller and to have an audience for my voice. I suppose, you know, as a kid, like any child of the 20th century who's creative, film and television was very appealing, but there were always these class boundaries, you know, between that industry and what I do. You know, I grew up in South Louisiana, always went to public schools and stuff like that for my college education. And film requires money. It requires that you live on one of the coasts. And most of the people in this industry, you know, generally have Ivy League degrees and stuff like that. So I began as a visual artist and in college transitioned into literature and philosophy. But one of the reasons I gravitated towards prose writing was because I had complete autonomy and it didn't require any sort of capital, you know. If you just have paper and a pen and you're willing to learn and spend the time it takes, you can become a writer. But in 2008, you know, teaching college and looking at where the world was going, I had decided that with the publication of my novel, Galveston, I was going to try to use that to get a foot in the door in Hollywood. And everything's, you know, been going great since.
How were you able to do that? It's just, to me, like, as a person who's never participated at all in that culture, right. How does one make an entry into that crazy world?
Well, you know what I've found, and this is absolutely true in my experience, is that Hollywood is the last meritocracy left. I mean, you can go, I mean, look at me. I went from never working in this industry 2 years ago to now I'm running my own HBO show where I'm the sole writer and executive producer, and I'm writing a movie for Tom Cruise. I mean, is there any industry in the world where a total newcomer can advance that swiftly based on nothing but merit, you know? So the way I got started in it was my novel Galveston got published by Scribner in the summer of 2010. And a film agent who works with my literary agent managed to sell the option for it. And that's not much money, and it doesn't really mean a lot. It just means, you know, somebody's paying to option your work for a film. But I asked the film agent, you know, what do I have to do to get that screenplay writing job, just because I thought it would be a good way to break in. Because one of the things you need to break into the industry as a writer is lots and lots of samples of screenwriting. You know, the agent said, have you ever written a screenplay? And I said, no. And she said, we have to write screenplays. And then I asked them, well, how do you become, you know, a working television writer? Because it seems like in television, the writer has much more command over the material, and he does. And they said, basically, you needed to write an original pilot that's really great, and a spec script, which is a script of an existing show. And that needs to be really great. And if you have those two samples, they can start trying to break me in. So that summer, I think I wrote 7 scripts in like a month and a half. And it created like a lot of noise for me over here, and I had a lot of meetings and with various producers and things like that. So I was flying from Indiana to LA quite a bit that summer, and I ended up taking a staffing position on the first season of The Killing for AMC, and HBO gave me a blind pilot deal, which is a set amount of money for a pilot script. So with those two things, I left my job in academia and moved the family out to L.A. But, you know, that's basically how I broke in.
Sure.
I wrote seven scripts in a month and a half.
Pizzolatto's True Detectives is slated to begin airing in 2013. He's also working on the remake of the movie Magnificent Seven, starring Tom Cruise. Another recent graduate who's broken into the screenwriting business is Tony Toast, a poetry graduate from 2004. He studied and was a colleague of Nick Pizzolatto's. Toast's first book of poetry, Invisible Bride, won the prestigious Walt Whitman Award while he was still studying at the University of Arkansas. He later went on to publish another book of poetry, as well as a book of music criticism on Johnny Cash. He decided that he really wanted to focus on film, however. Unlike Pizzolatto, Toast does not live in L.A. He lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, but he has been writing for the TV series Longmire and is shopping television ideas right now. I was curious to find out about the transition from writing poetry to writing screenplays.
There's more kind of overlap than I think you'd imagine, because like I think, like, especially in modern poetry, the image is the often the meaning-making unit in a poem. Yeah, I might be a little old school in that, and the old William Carlos Williams, like, you know, provide a series of charged images, and then the mind will begin deriving emotions and making sense of those. And screenplays, a little bit like that. You're trying to stage, structure, images, scenes, even with as little dialogue as possible, that make a kind of emotional, dramatic sense. And I think poetry was a good testing ground for that. Also, getting a sense of having an ear for the sound of words aloud, since you have to read your work with some kind and have it hopefully have some kind of rhythmic authority. That kind of sense of the externality of language. That's something I think, like, I'm kind of lucky that I didn't do fiction first, because even though I probably could have used a lot more practice on narrative structure, I never had the sense of internalized narrative and self-monologues going on that I think a lot of fiction rightly relies upon it. And so jumping into screenwriting, script writing, where everything has to be externalized, I didn't have to travel as far or shed as many habits that maybe somebody who'd been writing fiction for 10, 15 years would have to shed. And so that way it was a good training ground.
I'll be the first to admit that I don't watch TV all that often. So I wanted to find out from Toast exactly what Longmire was all about.
Longmire is a very cool, I think, show that just finished up its first season this summer on A&E. It was a pretty big success. It got renewed for a second season. It's pulled in kind of the biggest numbers that A&E's had for a drama so far. And it's about a widowed sheriff, about 50 years old, in rural Wyoming. And he's got this big, vast county that he oversees, and it's adjacent to an Indian reservation. And there's a kind of, it really has, it's interesting because it melds a little bit. It's from the people who did The Closer. The executive producers all worked on The Closer and helped create that. And so there's that sense of a, if you're familiar with The Closer, there's a procedural, like, crime of the week element, but it's also much more character-based and psychologically curious about its characters and its crimes than maybe your the network version of a procedural, the cable version. So there, it melds that kind of template with a lot of the iconography of your traditional Western.
This is Ozarks at Large. One more favorite story before we end this Boxing Day edition of Ozarks at Large. Sometimes I get really excited about the people who come to town that I get to talk to.
Do you?
I do. There's a gentleman here, middle of the year, who had written a book about time travel. Not fiction, not science fiction, but how it might happen.
You were really excited about this.
I was very excited about this. And it's been optioned for a movie, Spike Lee.
Oh, that's right.
Not necessarily time travel, but his life. Mm-hmm. And coming from the inner city, and his father died at a very young age. But here's just part of that conversation. It was a Classics Illustrated comic book version of a story by Wells, The Time Machine, that helped influence Ronald Mallett's desire to study physics, black holes, and possibly time travel. Mallett first wanted to travel in time when he was 10 years old and his father died suddenly. He's written a memoir about the tragedy and about his career in theoretical physics called Time Traveler. Movie rights for that book were purchased by Spike Lee in 2008. Ronald Mallett is a physics professor at the University of Connecticut. Last week, he discussed theoretical physics in a number of speaking appearances on the University of Arkansas campus. During a brief conversation before his public lecture, Ronald Mallett discussed his journey into the academic world.
My father, who for me was larger than life, I mean, he was fought in the Second World War as a battlefield medic, and he used the GI Bill to become a television technician in the Bronx. And the thing is, I was the oldest of four children. It's typical African-American family. Typical as it could be in the 50s. And the thing is that he looked healthy. He looked robust. The thing is, what we didn't realize is that he had a weak heart, and he died of a massive heart attack. He was only 33 years old, and I was 10. And it destroyed my world. I mean, it shattered it. The thing that I was lucky about was the fact that he thought education was very important. And he would bring me little toys like gyroscopes and crystal radio sets, and he loved to read. And that was the thing that helped me. And even though, I was reading some books, my favorites were the Classic Illustrated, because what they did was they would actually take classic books and then put them in an illustrated form. And then at the end of it, they would actually encourage people to read the original. So about a year after he died, I came across the issue was H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. And that turned everything around for me, because before that I had been a rather depressed kid. But now, all of a sudden, I had a focus. I had a mission in life. I thought, if I could build a time machine, I could see him again, maybe tell him what was going to happen and change things. And after he died, we plunged into poverty. It was terrible. So that came a secret mission. And the reason I say secret is because even at the age of 11, I was astute enough to realize that if I told people that I wanted to build a time machine, since they were already worried about the depressions I was having, I didn't know that I wanted to deal with the consequences of that. But I kept that as my secret mission. And the thing is that what was fortunate for me was about a year after that, I came across this popular book about Einstein. It's called The Universe and Dr. Einstein. And in it, it said Einstein said that time was not something that was absolute. It could, in fact, be altered. You could change it. One of the ways you could change it is by going fast enough, that if you move fast enough, a clock would slow down. So what I realized is that if Einstein, because I knew he was this great genius, and incidentally, what was interesting is he died in the same year my father did, in 1955. And the thing is that I thought, if he says that time can be altered, then maybe this notion of a time machine that H.G. Wells was talking about is real and not just, you know, science fiction. So that became my second passion, was to learn everything about Einstein. So eventually I learned enough about it. I mean, I'm skipping through a lot. I should mention that recently I've written a book called The Time Traveler. Okay, it's a time traveler of science's personal mission to make time travel reality. And I talk about you know, what it was really like, you know, growing up and the ups and downs and everything like that. But eventually, I followed my father's footsteps. I went to the Air Force during the Vietnam War era. Then I used the GI Bill to go to Penn State. And I became a physicist, a theoretical physicist. I kept it a secret, even all of that time. And the way I was able to keep it as a secret was the fact that there was something that I could study that I found out affected time, and it was considered legitimate. And these were black holes. Black holes, as you may know, are stars that have actually used up their internal fuel, and then the star starts to collapse. And as the star starts to collapse, the gravity around the star becomes so great that the very light that tries to escape from the star gets pulled back to the star. So if you're standing outside, you see nothing. And that's why it's called a black hole, because all the light's being pulled in. Turns out that black holes also affect time. The closer you get to a black hole, the more time will slow down. That is to say, if someone's watching you as you're getting close to a black hole, they would actually see your clock slow down. Now, the thing, Kyle, when I'm saying time and a clock, I'm not talking about just a mechanical clock. Your heart rate, your metabolism are clocks. That means that your heart rate would be slowing down. You would actually be aging less than someone who was not near the black hole. So if you got close enough to the black hole without going into it, you would actually find that it would be a kind of a time machine, because you would find that everyone else was aging at a normal rate compared to
them. Because they're not near the black hole.
They're right. They're not near the black hole, exactly. So when you left the black hole and came back out, you might find that you're only a few hours, you know, older, but hundreds of years could have passed for everyone else. So that meant that if I studied black holes, then I could do this. So black holes were considered a crazy idea, but was considered legitimate crazy, unlike time machines. So that's what I made my career, is studying black holes. And eventually, I did have a breakthrough in the real science of time travel, because I realized that there was another way of altering time that could be done without using a black hole. And that was my main breakthrough. What I realized was that light actually can create gravity. Now, remember, one of the things I said is that the gravity of a black hole can actually affect time. So that means that gravity can affect time, okay? And that's part of Einstein's theory of relativity. My breakthrough was that if light can create gravity and gravity can affect time, then that means that light can affect time. So my idea was to build a type of a time machine that actually used light, lasers, in fact. And what I found is that by using that, it is possible to actually alter time in such a way that you may be able to go into the past as well as the future.
Thank you so much for your time.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you, Kyle.
Ronald Mallett is a professor of physics at the University of Connecticut. He recently spoke on the University of Arkansas campus as a guest of the university's physics department. His memoir is titled Time Traveler. All right, two more days of this, but before we go, I'd like to ask a question of my staff. Recently, I got on stage with the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas and did a performance, and I can't read music, I have no rhythm, and that really got me out of my comfort zone to get up there and have to work with the music. If you were going to do a story in 2013 that got you out of your comfort zone, what would it involve? And I will start again, because I think I would like to do a story in 2013 about how to fly a plane.
Oh, yeah, that'd be really tough for you.
It would be. It'd be tough. Look, my palms are sweating just thinking about it. But, you know, you can take lessons and go up and just have the throttle for a few seconds and see what that feels like. Christina?
Oh.
Okay, we'll come back to you. Jackie, do you have one?
Yeah, actually, and I pitched it to you earlier this year. It's regarding the allowance of horse slaughter plants. They were outlawed across the nation, but now they're being allowed, and they're trying to site one up in Missouri. And I think some of you know I volunteer at a horse rescue. But
so that would definitely...
It would be hard, but I think it's an important story to report.
Timothy?
I know you said a story about flying, but getting me out of my comfort zone would be a story about skydiving, jumping out of a plane.
Oof.
That would be some good sound.
That would be good sound.
You know,
you had that.
I've had two people do that story. Jim Ragsdale, who lives here again, when he was a student, he did some stories for me. He got into the plane, but wisely, I thought, did not get out. He said, you know what? I've decided that this just doesn't make sense. And they don't push you. But then Dan Bennett,
yes.
The wonderful Dan Bennett, actually did the story. He worked for us part-time for several years. And it's the cliche, but he got down and he wanted to instantly do it again. He said it was such a rush. And they're tandem jumps. You had to do them
right.
together. But he, so...
And his Marantz recorder was a cassette recorder.
Yes,
Marantz
yes,
survived.
Yes,
yes.
But we gave him the worst one in case it broke.
Nice.
It was one. Yeah. Well, but he was safe, and the story ran. Maybe we'll play that sometime. Do you have one?
I just think in general, if I had to interview anyone where I felt like I'd have to ask uncomfortable questions, because. Mm-hmm. I'm a cultural journalist, and I mostly talk about people's creative projects and things, and it's just a fun sort of thing. So anytime if I was forced to sit down with someone who I felt like I really needed to, like, pick their brain on really important issues and ask them questions that they probably don't want to answer, I'd probably be really squeamish about that.
That's a good answer. I like that. Antoinette, do you have one that would...
I don't know. I feel like I have a pretty...
wide. I think of all of us here, you, and no disrespect to, go ahead. What were you going to say, Chrissy?
I was going to say, I can't think of anything either.
Yeah.
Like, well, I'm not afraid of heights. I'm not, I don't
right.
know.
And I feel okay. Like, and okay. I feel like anything I had an apprehension on, a lot of it I've done over the years. You know what I mean?
Let's say I come down to your office and I say, you know what? There's this herpetology place.
Yeah.
How would you feel about that?
It's fine.
Snakes?
Is that what that is? I was mm-hmm. like, I have no idea what that is.
So I asked.
I mean,
you,
I'm uncomfortable around snakes, I guess, but that's more like a fear. I don't know if that's like a...
Uncomfortable. Okay,
hey.
We'll go with that.
I don't know if that's like what you mean, though, because I mean, like, my comfort zone, I think, as far as people that I talk to, I think I might be more uncomfortable, like, on the bottom of my list of people I want to talk to are some of those, like, professors, like the experts that come mm-hmm. through that you talk to a lot of times, because I think that can be kind of intimidating because they know everything about whatever it is, and you don't want to feel like you're wasting their time asking stupid questions.
Right.
And it's hard to do research because it's like you're never going to know as much as they know. So it's that's a little stressful.
And that's what
I
that's,
guess.
And that's what our job is. We interview people who know more about the subject than we do to tell an audience that mostly knows less mm-hmm. now than we do, at least at the moment, that we're done. So it's a very interesting. Christina, nothing?
I mean, I'm having trouble. I mean,
okay.
I kind of agree with Antoinette. You know, the story that aired earlier was about the glass blower, and, you know, I wasn't nervous walking in there. But there are some situations, you know, I don't know, like going to a press conference is sort of nerve-wracking for me. I don't know why.
Okay.
But, you know, that's I'm just trying to look back on things mm-hmm. that have made me nervous, you know, this year. So I guess more serious things. Yeah.
All right. Well, tomorrow we'll talk about some more of our favorite stories. Thank you all.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.